syncopated yelps, screams that curdle your insides. The homies didn't do anything that night. They went home instead. The price of it all delivered to them, courtesy of a grieving mother's vocal cords. After spending the entire afternoon with Raoul's mom and family, I wanted to get back to the office before closing time. I knew that the homies needed to see me, and I them. With 10 minutes left on the day's clock, my workers filed into my tiny office, one by one, to hug, to cry some, and to take my emotional temperature. Each one attentive, tender, and consumed by a self-forgetfulness that only saints, really, are able to pull off. Then I'm there alone with the ache that doesn't leave you and the echoey silence of the vacated headquarters. Even the ghosts of the place seem to have stepped out. When Freddy, one of my workers, appears, standing in my doorway, he asks how I'm doing, and I sigh, beckoning him to sit. "I know your heart is breaking," he says, beginning to cry. "I wish I had a magic wand to pass over your pain." As an adult, I can't recall ever crying with another person more fully than at that moment. We both just lose ourselves in sobbing. Usually, I'd put myself, as the homies say, on check status, but even I couldn't pull this off at the moment. I'd been holding this enormous, outsized grief in check for so long, and had sudden permission to release it in the gentle urging and vast heart of Freddy. At 23 years old, he had worked at Homeboy for some years now in a wide variety of sights and tasks, but his singularly spectacular temper required frequent changes of venue. First the silkscreen plant, then the bulky item drop-off center, and now here at the headquarters. He surely, at this moment, knew how to use his deep rage and essential wound to hold all that I was carrying. "You know, all of us here are drowning," Freddy begins with difficulty, the tears a tide that he's swimming against. "And you just reach in and sweep us up." We resume our wailing, holding our heads, rocking some, unable to speak. Then Freddy, with his teeth clenched and something nearly resembling his frequent bursts of anger, points his finger at me with a holy determination. "I swear to you," he says, "if someone offered me a choice right now, $1 million or a chance to swoop you up." Freddy stops and swallows hard against this overflow of crying. "I would swoop you up." Through my tears, I am barely able to eke out, "You just did. You just did." Sister Elaine Roulette, the founder of my mother's house in New York, was asked, "How do you work with the poor?" She answered, "You don't. You share your life with the poor." It's as basic as crying together. It is about casting your lot before it ever becomes about changing their lot. Success and failure, ultimately, have little to do with living the gospel. Jesus just stood with the outcasts until they were welcomed, or until he was crucified, whichever came first. The American poet Jack Gilbert writes, "The pregnant heart is driven to hopes that are the wrong size for this world." The strategy and stance of Jesus was consistent in that it was always out of step with the world. Jesus defied all the categories upon which the world insisted. Good, evil, success, failure, pure, impure. Surely, he was an equal opportunity pisser-offer in this regard. The right wing would stare at him and question where he chose to stand. They hated that he aligned himself with the unclean, those outside, those folks you ought neither to touch nor be near. He hobnobbed with the leper, shared table fellowship with the sinner, and rendered himself ritually impure in the process. They found it offensive that, to boot, Jesus had no regard for their wedge issues, their constitutional amendments, or their culture wars. The left was equally annoyed. They wanted to see the 10-point plan, the revolution in high gear, the toppling of sinful social structures. They were impatient with his brand of solidarity. They wanted to see him taking the right stand on issues, not just standing in the right place. But Jesus just stood with the outcast. The left screamed, "Don't just stand there, do something." And the right maintained, "Don't stand with those folks at all." Both sides, seeing Jesus as the wrong size for this world, came to their own reasons for wanting him dead. Both sides were equally impressed as he unrolled the scroll and spoke of good news to the poor, sight to the blind, liberty to captives. Yet only a handful of verses later, they wanted to throw Jesus over a cliff. How do we get the world to change anyway? Dorothy Day asked critically, where were the saints to try and change the social order? Not just minister to the slaves, but to do away with slavery. Dorothy Day is a hero of mine, but I disagree with her here. You actually abolish slavery by accompanying the slave. We don't strategize our way out of slavery. We solidarize, if you will, our way toward its demise. We stand in solidarity with the slave, and by so doing, we diminish slavery's ability to stand. By casting our lot with the gang member, we hasten the demise of demonizing. All Jesus asks is, where are you standing? And after chilling defeat and soul-numbing failure, he asks again, are you still standing there? Can we stay faithful and persistent in our fidelity even when things seem not to succeed? I suppose Jesus could have chosen a strategy that worked better, evidence-based outcomes, that didn't end in the cross. But he couldn't find a strategy more soaked with fidelity than the one he embraced. I'm in a rush one late afternoon and driving out of the church parking lot when La Shady stands right in front of my car. She's a big girl of 19, large-hipped and breasted, looking more like a woman of twice her age. Cradled in her right arm and resting on her sizable right hip is her one-year-old daughter, Jennifer. Shady's man and father of her daughter was Leonardo, whom I had buried 3 months before, in a fracas in the gas station at 4th and Boyle between Leonardo and five members of a rival gang. A nervous, tiny gang member, viewing the fight from inside the car, fumbled with a gun and shot wildly at those duking it out. His bullet found Leonardo. Shady uses the hand not attached to her daughter to serve as a stop sign in front of my car, and she rushes over to my open window on the driver's side. She leans in and kisses me. She's draped in a huge black and white Raiders jersey with a number on the front. Where you going, G? I know enough not to tell her. I'm heading to a peace treaty meeting I've set up between the female members of her gang and the one that killed her man. She would have been one I'd considered too much of a hothead, and even so, the rawness of Leonardo's death is still too dominant in the ring for her, knocking out reason, calm, and any hope for peace. She is not on my invitation list. I'm going on an errand. Girls and gangs really represent just a tiny percentage of the overall gang population. The numbers vary from 5 to 10%. I would suggest favoring the lower number. Gangs are a guy thing, primarily. It is far more common to have gang malls, the girls who dated the guys in one gang, as opposed to those in another. Those who are actually jumped into neighborhoods perform reconnaissance, stir things up, and often shame the males into fighting. Are you going to let that vato just walk over there across the street and not do anything about it? The only times I've ever been remotely hurt in all these years always came in breaking up fights between girl gang members. Guys would stop the second I'd arrive. The parting of the Red Sea of brawling homies as I'd make my way through them. Girls, on the other hand, require backup. You can't get them to stop. Always bring someone with you to break things up. Shady is a tough one. There's a certain gruffness to her, and when she's not of a hard-edged mind, she's impossibly shy. This seems to be that rare moment in which she is neither rough nor retiring. She is atypically glad to see me and has an urgency to talk I don't recognize. Gee, you got 2 minutes? I had a dream last night, and I need you to explain it to me. Homies always thought I possessed the lexicon to dream interpretation. I did nothing to encourage this. They just presumed it was part of my credentials. She crouches closer to me and gives Jennifer a good hop to readjust her on her hip. She leans left to accommodate her there. In the dream, she enters Dolores Mission Church at night, and as she walks down the center aisle, she sees, in this dimly lit place, me standing up in front, vested for Mass. By my side is the coffin of a tiny baby, and the lid is up. Shady doesn't walk closer at first, but I summon and wave her forward. She trusts me enough to keep walking, but she admits she is absolutely terrified to peer into this coffin. I'm smiling and encouraging her to keep going. Shady finally reaches the casket and dares to peek. But before Shady can even fully get her head over the tiny box, a white dove flies out of it, startling her. It circles the inside of the church and flies above, back and forth, until it lands on her shoulder. Then she wakes up. What's it mean, G? Well, it's obvious what it means, I say, clueless as to the dream's meaning. Since I was late for a summit, and because my sense of Shady's mood generally is that she is one to dig in the heels of her Nike Cortez and not give peace a chance, I self-servingly give her my take. Well, everyone knows that the white dove stands for peace. And so God is asking you to move toward forgiveness and healing and peace. And everything's going to be fine. She listens. But there are wheels turning that seem to be operating well out of my view. I abandon my own tight grasp on punctuality, and for the first time, I really see her standing in front of me, juggling her daughter, her Raiders jersey flapping with the wind. I place my hand on her forearm, resting on the door of my car. But here's the only thing that matters, kiddo. How did the dream make you feel? Shady begins to cry, and her daughter, curious at first, soon joins Shady in sympathy. That's the thing, G. At first I was scared, like maybe that's my daughter in the casket. But when I saw the bird, I only felt peace and love in my heart. I had not ever seen Shady cry like this. God only wants you to feel those things, mijita. Love in your heart. Peace. You're okay. She reached into the car with more verve than usual, nearly whomping Jennifer in the head, as she threw her arms around me, squeezing hard and thanking me harder. At close to midnight that same day, Shady is crammed into the middle seat in the back of a car filled with gang members. They've driven well out of her barrio, and the guys in the car are from a neighborhood not her own. They drive, and hand signs get thrown out the window at rivals standing on some street corner. The corner guys yell and scream all manner of foulness at the car, and Shady and the gang squeal rubber out of there laughing. Not a block away, a corner vato finds his gun. Shady slumps in the back seat. Only one bullet entered the car that night, and it happened to find the back of Shady's head. Now what does the dream mean? Told to me just hours before Shady's life was to end. I have no idea. Except that we are unfailingly called to stand with Shady and all those who grieved her passing. Beyond that, I don't really know. Allowing our hearts to be broken by the very thing that breaks the heart of God. In the end, what needs to get disrupted will find its disruption in our solidarity and in our intimate kinship with the outcast, who too infrequently knows the peace of a white dove resting on a shoulder. What is the failure of death, after all, when it is measured against what rises in you when you catch sight of this white bird? Nietzsche writes, "The weight of all things needs to be measured anew. Enough death and tragedy come your way, and who would blame you for wanting a new way to measure? If we choose to stand in the right place, God, through us, creates a community of resistance without our even realizing it. To embrace the strategy of Jesus is to be engaged in what Dean Brackley calls downward mobility. Our locating ourselves with those who have been endlessly excluded becomes an act of visible protest. For no amount of our screaming at the people in charge to change things can change them. The margins don't get erased by simply insisting that the powers that be erase them. The trickle-down theory doesn't really work here. The powers bent on waging war against the poor and the young and the other will only be moved to kinship when they observe it. Only when we can see a community where the outcast is valued and appreciated will we abandon the values that seek to exclude. Jesus was always too busy being faithful to worry about success. I'm not opposed to success. I just think we should accept it only if it is a byproduct of our fidelity. If our primary concern is results, we will choose to work only with those who give us good ones. Myriad are the examples at Homeboy Industries of homies coloring way outside the lines and being given their 98th chance. Maybe it's because we are often forced to start where others have stopped. Some on my senior staff wanted to change our motto, printed on our t-shirts, from "Nothing stops a bullet like a job" to "You just can't disappoint us enough." Others would mention that there seemed to be no consequences for some actions, and of course, in the real world, there are consequences. Someone told me once, what's it take to get fired at Homeboy? Release nerve gas? When it seems the best thing for a person, I have, often enough, fired someone I call the person in and say, the day won't ever come when I will withdraw love and support from you. I am simply in your corner till the wheels fall off. Oh, by the way, I have to let you go. They always agree with me, nearly always. There's no question that everybody working at Homeboy would have been fired anyplace else, including me, I suppose. Just ask my board. But as Mark Torres, beloved spiritual guide at Homeboy Industries, says, we see in the homies what they don't see in themselves until they do. There was a homegirl straight out of prison with award-winning and alarming tattoos all over her face. She began work at the silkscreen. First day, a fight. Second day, she came utterly illuminated on chronic marijuana. Third day, she arrived at work in a car filled with her homies. This is against our rules. Oh, and the car was stolen. This is against, well, everybody's rules. I suppose we could have fired her. And yet we decided, with all the no-matter-whatness we could muster, that she would give up on us long before we would ever give up on her. And give up she did. She just stopped showing up. We'll be ready for her when she comes back. You stand with the least likely to succeed until success is succeeded by something more valuable, kinship. You stand with the belligerent, the surly, and the badly behaved until bad behavior is recognized for the language it is, the vocabulary of the deeply wounded and of those whose burdens are more than they can bear. Jesus jostled irreparably the purity code of the shot callers of his day. He recognized that it was precisely this code that kept folks from kinship. Maybe success has become the new purity code. And Jesus shows us that the desire for purity, 9 times out of 10, is in fact the enemy of the gospel. Funders sometimes say, we don't fund efforts, we fund outcomes. We all hear this and think how sensible, practical, realistic, hard-nosed, and clear-eyed it is. But maybe Jesus doesn't know why we're nodding so vigorously. Without wanting to, we sometimes allow our preference for the poor to morph into a preference for the well-behaved and the most likely to succeed, even if you get better outcomes when you work with those folks. If success is our engine, we sidestep the difficult and belligerent and eventually abandon the slow work of God. Failure and death become insurmountable. I see Manny in the neighborhood, and I am not one bit happy. Once homies move away from the projects, I tell them they have no business here. Once I saw a homie named Muggsy, now in his early 30s, 3 kids, lives away from the neighborhood, good construction job, and he's in the barrio. So what the hell are you doing here? I ask him. Well, I'm just going to buy some beer at Moon's store. Look, dog, you can buy beer anywhere. Yeah, but, he says, not every place accepts food stamps. The fact that I rarely win these battles does not keep me from the broken record of my insisting. When I see Manny, I begin calmly. Okay, Manny, what are you doing here? Manny wants to diffuse quickly. Oh, I'm just visiting. I turn my voice into a hospital's loudspeaker. May I have your attention, please? Visiting hours are now over. Manny knows enough to change the subject. Go ahead and congratulate me, he says. For what? I concede, air hissing out of my balloon. On Monday, I begin college at Rio Hondo. Son, I'm proud of you. Now go home. Manny had been one of 20 workers from a variety of gangs who built our child care center. It took them 2 years to build. It would have taken professional types 4 months tops. We opted instead to begin the wrong size for this world construction crew. Nothing made Manny prouder than to have his name inscribed on the building's wall. "I built that," he'd say. Not 3 hours later, as Manny pulls onto the ramp for the freeway home, a rival sees him and opens up fire. Within hours, the doctors are enlisting me to convince the family to donate Manny's organs. These things take time. For several days, I join in the vigil with his lady Irma, 8 months pregnant with their second child. She does not leave his side. I stop asking her to take periodic respites. She lines the bed tray with photos, mutually meaningful, of Manny Jr. and the family altogether. I watch as an endless procession of homies and family members and friends come through to say goodbye to Manny's comatose body. The homies tenderly drape rosarios around his neck and kiss him and hug him. Across Manny's chest is a tattoo of the song title, "I'm Still Here," which he put on the last time he was shot. Standing in the room, I returned to some months before when Manny had called me, quite paniqueado about something. Usually he called about his fear of violating probation again. I meet him at the iron stairwell outside of Irma's apartment in the projects. When I get there, he is already crying. It occurs to me to ask him well into our conversation, "What do you want, Manny?" He knows what I'm talking about. "What do you most deeply, truly want?" Manny closes his eyes and folds his hands, and the obvious intensity may well burst something. He has the look of a man who, if he can articulate this correctly, might set himself on the right path. When Manny returns from his search, he says only, "I just want to be a good father, but I don't know how to be one." Guideposts were not plentiful. I had buried his own father of a heroin overdose the year before, and his childhood was surrounded by good people intractably stuck in the chaos that only PCP can produce. When I met him years and years before, he was a little kid whose room and sanctuary was a closet. I finally get Manny's grandmother to sign the release to donate his organs. "Not his eyes, though," she says. "Not his eyes." As the two nurses wheel Manny to surgery for the harvesting of his organs, one nurse turns to the other and shakes her head in disgust, no doubt eyeing Manny's tattoos. "I mean," she says, rolling her eyes, "who would want this monster's heart?" The other nurse stops the gurney mid-hallway and turns on her co-worker with a clarity that may well have surprised herself. "How dare you call this kid a monster? Didn't you see his family, his friends, his son? He was 19 years old, for God's sakes. He belonged to somebody. Shame on you." I only know this happened because I gave an in-service to the nurses at White Memorial Hospital. The chastising nurse tearfully told her story in front of everybody during the Q&A. "I cried all the way home that night," she said. Obviously, after having buried 172 young human beings, all killed violently because of gangs, I've had to come to terms with the failure of death. Death, where is your sting? La muerte ya no tiene dominio. Are words I've spoken from the pulpit many times. Death has no power. Easy for me to say. There's much self-protection in saying it, however. Otherwise, you fear actually losing your mind. Annie Dillard writes, So once in Israel, love came to us incarnate and stood in the doorway between two worlds, and we were all afraid. Working with gang members means always trying to make sense of life in the doorway. Yes, the wheat dies, but check out the fruit. Sure, there's pain in childbirth, but here's this kid. Who's still looking at the ashes once the phoenix has risen? You're always on the lookout for fates worse than death. And it turns out there are a slew of them. An Algerian monk, threatened with death, says to those who will inflict it, "What do we have to fear after all? To be thrown into the tenderness of God?" That's certainly where I want to be, even if on most days the fear seems to triumph. The owner of a vast, expansive heart, and among the most heroic women I know, is Soledad, the mother of four. I met her second oldest, Ronnie, when he was a sophomore at Roosevelt High School. I suspect he began working at our office after school, shortly after his brother Angel started to work at our silkscreen factory. Angel was from a gang and 2 years older than Ronnie, who was never from any barrio. Shortly after 9/11, Ronnie got his diploma, didn't even graduate on stage, and joined the Marines. Once, he and Soledad visited me so I could give a special blessing for Ronnie, who was headed to some secret location, which turned out to be Afghanistan. Sometime later, Ronnie was home on leave and walking back to the house after a midnight run to Jack in the Box. Soledad can hear from the bedroom the most dreaded question in the barrio. Someone is hitting up Ronnie. "Where you from?" If you are not from a gang, you say, "I ain't from nowhere." Variations on this can be, "I don't bang." This could mean, "I am a gang member, but I don't play that anymore," or, "I am not a gang member." She strains to hear what he says. He might have laughed, or even said, "The Marines." She needs no straining to hear the shots that follow. Ronnie dies in her arms outside their kitchen door. He is shot 4 times in the back and 2 times in the head. They shot his hand off. Ronnie was given a full military burial. Soledad was handed a folded flag. For the next 6 months, there was no consoling Soledad. She quit her job and rarely left the house. She dressed in black every day, bathed infrequently, didn't bother with hair or makeup. Among my proudest possessions is a photograph of Angel, her oldest son, in burgundy gown and gold sash and mortarboard at his graduation from Roosevelt. Very few homies pull this off, and Angel was deservedly proud. Angel sits his mother down on a Sunday morning, 6 months after Ronnie's death. "Look," he says to Soledad, "you have to stop this. You have 3 kids left, and we need you. So I want you to go throw these black clothes away, take a bath, do your hair, and put some makeup on. It's time." Soledad's firstborn breaks through the solid mass of grief that had encased her soul and left her heart immobile for all this time. So she does it. Bathes, wears something with color in it, fixes her hair, and puts on makeup. She emerges from her room, and she is radiant. Angel cups her face in his hands. "You look gorgeous." He doesn't hesitate to add, "It's about damn time." That afternoon, Angel is sitting on his front porch, eating a sandwich, and there is a commotion down the block. There is a kid running with all his might. He is from Angel's barrio. He is being chased by 2 enemies. When they catch up to him, the kid is able to disappear from their sight. This leaves the two panting in front of Angel's front porch. He knows enough to scramble wildly toward his front door. The shooting begins, and Soledad runs to the source of the sound. She would say later that she wished the shooters hadn't left until they had also killed her. It being Sunday, I was celebrating Mass in the varied detention facilities, so I came late to the news of Angel's death. By the time I reached Soledad's living room later that day, she is huddled in a corner. Forget Kleenex. Forget handkerchief. Soledad is sobbing into a huge bath towel. And the few of us there found our arms too short to wrap around this kind of pain. I see Soledad a lot, but this one day, 2 years after the death of Angel, I see her in front of the office, and we hug. How you doing, kiddo? Soledad grabs my arm and thinks and considers her words. You know, I love the two kids that I have. I hurt for the two that are gone. She begins to cry and shows the slightest embarrassment at the size of her honesty. The hurt wins. The hurt wins. 2 months later, Soledad is taken to the hospital for an irregular heartbeat and chest pain. I visit her in her room, and she tells me what happened the night she came to the emergency room. They have her on a gurney in White Memorial's ER. The doctors are tending to her with EKGs and the like when there is a rush of activity at the entrance, with a flurry of bodies and medical staff moving into their prescribed roles. A teenage gang member is rushed to the vacant space right next to Soledad. The kid is covered in blood from multiple gunshot wounds, and they begin cutting off his clothes. The wounds are too serious to waste time pulling the curtain that separates Soledad from this kid fighting for his life. People are pounding on his chest and inserting IVs. Soledad turns and sees him. She recognizes him as a kid from the gang that most certainly robbed her of her sons. As I saw this kid, she tells me, I just kept thinking of what my friends might say if they were here with me. They'd say, pray that he dies. But she just looked at this tiny kid, struggling to sidestep the fate of her sons as the doctors work and scream, we're losing him! We're losing him! And I began to cry, as I have never cried before. And I started to pray the hardest I've ever prayed. Please, don't let him die. I don't want his mom to go through what I have. And the kid lived. Sometimes, it only seems that the hurt wins. Mary Oliver writes, there are things you can't reach, but you can reach out to them, and all day long. In the end, effective outcomes and a piling of success stories aren't the things for which we reach. Though, who am I kidding? I prefer them to abject failure and decades of death. But it's not about preference. It's about the disruption of categories that leads us to abandon the difficult, the disagreeable, and the least likely to go very far. On most days, if I'm true to myself, I just want to share my life with the poor, regardless of result. I want to lean into the challenge of intractable problems with as tender a heart as I can locate. knowing that there is some divine ingenuity here, the slow work of God, that gets done if we're faithful. Maybe the world could use a dose of a wrong size approach. Otherwise, the hurt wins. Maybe there are things you can't reach, but you can stretch your arm across a gurney and forgive and heal. Equal souls all day long. Chapter 9. Kinship. Mother Teresa diagnosed the world's ills in this way. We've just forgotten that we belong to each other. Kinship is what happens to us when we refuse to let that happen. With kinship as the goal, other essential things fall into place. Without it, no justice, no peace. I suspect that were kinship our goal, we would no longer be promoting justice. We would be celebrating it. Kinship has a way of sneaking up on you even as you seek to create it. I celebrate Catholic services on a rotating basis in 25 detention institutions in Los Angeles County. Juvenile halls, probation camps, jails, and state youth authority facilities. After Mass, in the gym or chapel or classroom, I hand out my card. The infomercial is always the same. Call me when you get out. I'll hook you up with a job. Take off your tattoos. Line you up with a counselor. I won't know where you are, but with this card, you'll know where I am. Don't slow drag, because if you do, you'll get popped again and end up right back here. So call me. I hand out thousands of cards a year. So a homie named Louis, 17 years old, appears in my office one day, bright, happy, and smiling. Never in my life had I seen more hickeys on a human being than on this guy. His entire neck is spotted with these chupetonazos. Even his cheeks are covered. I'm thinking Mr. Guinness of the World Records might be interested in talking to Louis. So here I am, he says, arms outstretched. I just got out yesterday. And he points at me with glee. And you are the very first person I came to see. I look at this giddy gang member and say, Louis, I have a feeling I was your second stop. The two of us collapse in laughter. And suddenly, there's kinship so quickly. Not service provider and service recipient. No daylight to separate. Just us. Exactly what God had in mind. Often, we strike the high moral distance that separates us from them. And yet, it is God's dream come true when we recognize that there exists no daylight between us. Serving others is good. It's a start. But it's just the hallway that leads to the grand ballroom. Kinship. Not serving the other, but being one with the other. Jesus was not a man for others. He was one with them. There is a world of difference in that. I suppose I never felt this kinship more keenly in my own life than when I was first diagnosed with leukemia. At this writing, I am several years cancer-free. Not long ago, a homie breathlessly said to me, I hear your cancer's in intermission. My leukemia has been in the lobby ever since, waiting in line for popcorn. The news of my illness first managed to reach most folks by way of the front page of the Sunday Los Angeles Times. Word spread, homies came out of the woodwork. My voicemail began to fill. Now it's our turn to take care of you, says Lala, a homegirl I've known forever. A huge homie named Fernie stands in front of my desk, tattooed and something of a fullback to whom God had forgotten to give a neck, tears glistening in his eyes. What do I have that you need? He says. meaning organs. I was more than a little happy to tell him I wasn't in need of any. At some point in mid-chemotherapy, I arrive at my office after a treatment. A tiny 15-year-old gang member plunks himself down in the chair facing my desk. He looks positively stricken. "I hear you have leukemia," his voice cracks. I nod solemnly. There's an awkward silence, which he finally fills. "My cat had leukemia." This just sits in the air. "Yeah," he says, "she died." "Oh," I say, "really sorry to hear that. Awfully glad you stopped by, though. You really picked me up right there." My favorite moment of all, though, came when Peanut called from jail. Collect. He had just read the news in the paper. "Hey," he says, screaming over the jailhouse din, "what's with this leukemia anyway?" "Well, it's cancer in the blood. The doctor says my white count's too high." Peanut is immediately dismissive. "Damn, these doctors." I can hear him shaking his head. "They don't be knowing nothing." "What do you mean?" "I mean, hello, course your white count's high. You white." I'm accepting more collect calls from jail now and calling them second opinions. No daylight to separate us. Only kinship. Inching ourselves closer to creating a community of kinship such that God might recognize it. Soon we imagine with God this circle of compassion. Then we imagine no one standing outside of that circle, moving ourselves closer to the margins so that the margins themselves will be erased. We stand there with those whose dignity has been denied. We locate ourselves with the poor and the powerless and the voiceless. At the edges, we join the easily despised and the readily left out. We stand with the demonized so that the demonizing will stop. We situate ourselves right next to the disposable so that the day will come when we stop throwing people away. The prophet Habakkuk writes, "The vision still has its time, presses on to fulfillment, and it will not disappoint. And if it delays, wait for it." Kinship is what God presses us on to, always hopeful that its time has come. I don't recognize Lencho when he steps into my office, though that is the first question he asked. "Remember me?" Truth is, I don't. He is 2 days fresh out of Corcoran State Prison. He has been locked up for 10 years, a juvenile tried as an adult. He was 14 years old when I met him at Central Juvenile Hall. Now at 24, his arms are all sleeved out, every inch covered in tattoos. His neck is blackened by the name of his gang, stretching from jawbone to collarbone. His head is shaved and covered with alarming tattoos. Most startling of all, though impressive, are two exquisitely etched devil's horns planted on his forehead. He says, "You know, I'm having a hard time finding a job." I think, well, maybe we can put our heads together on this one. I'm about to nudge him in the direction of our tattoo removal clinic when he says, "I've never had a job in my life. Been locked up since I was a kid." I suggest that we change this. I tell him to begin work tomorrow, Tuesday, at Homeboy Silkscreen. In operation for more than 10 years, nearly 500 rival gang members have worked there, screen printing and embroidering apparel for more than 2,500 customers. On Wednesday, I call the Homeboy Silkscreen factory to check on Chamuco, the affectionate way of addressing Satan, our newest worker. Lencho is brought to the phone. "So," I ask, "how's it feel to be a working man?" "It feels proper," he says. In fact, I'm like that vato in the commercial. You know the guy, the one who keeps walking up to total strangers and says, I just lowered my cholesterol. Yeah, that's me right there. I admit to him that this whole cholesterol thing has flown right over my head. I mean, yesterday after work, I'm sitting at the back of the bus, dirty and tired. And I mean, I just couldn't help myself. I kept turning to total strangers. Just coming back. First day on the job. He turns to another. Just getting off. My first day at work. He tells me this, and I can't help but imagine the people on the bus, half wondering if mothers are clutching their kids more closely. Surely someone is overhearing Lencho and thinking, bien hecho, nice going. I suspect it's equally certain that someone catching Lencho's outburst reflects inwardly, what a waste of a perfectly good job. The wrong idea has taken root in the world, and the idea is this. There just might be lives out there that matter less than other lives. The prophet Jeremiah writes, in this place of which you say it is a waste, there will be heard again the voice of mirth and the voice of gladness, the voices of those who sing. Lencho's voice matters. To that end, we choose to become what child psychiatrist Alice Miller calls enlightened witnesses, people who through their kindness, tenderness, and focused, attentive love return folks to themselves. It is a returning, not a measuring up. Lencho is returned to himself and announces this with clarion voice at the back of a bus. We don't hold the bar up and ask people to measure up to it. One simply shows up and commits to telling the truth. At Homeboy Industries, we seek to tell each person this truth. They are exactly what God had in mind when God made them. And then we watch from this privileged place as people inhabit this truth. Nothing is the same again. No bullet can pierce this. No prison walls can keep this out. And death can't touch it. It is just that huge. But much stands in the way of this liberating truth. You need to dismantle shame and disgrace, coaxing out the truth in people who've grown comfortable believing its opposite. One day I have three homies in my car as I'm headed to give a talk. While there, they will set up a table and sell Homeboy Homegrown merchandise. Our banter in the car spans the range of bagging on each other. We laugh a lot, and I'm distracted enough not to notice that the gas tank is on empty. I lean into Jojo, the homie occupying shotgun. Oye, dog, be on the lookout for a gas station. He doesn't seem to wholly trust my judgment. He leans toward the gas gauge and dismisses my call. You're fine, he says. ¿Cómo que I'm fine? I'm on échale, cabrón. Waving at him, I say. Hello, E means empty. Jojo looks at me with bona fide shock. E means empty? Well, yeah. What you think it meant? Enough. Well, what did you think F stood for? Finished. After I thank him for visiting our planet, I realize this is exactly how the dismantling process has to play itself out. Homies stare into the mirror and pronounce empty. Our collective task is to suggest instead, enough. Enough gifts. Enough talent. Enough goodness. When you have enough, there's plenty. Or if their verdict is finished, we are asked to lead them instead to fullness, the place within, where they find in themselves exactly what God had in mind. It would be hard to overstate how daunting it is to conjure new images and reconstruct messages. When Richard arrived at Homeboy Industries, he was a 19-year-old for whom sadness was a constant refrain. Smiles were occasional and fleeting. He would tend toward beating himself up, often for being the only gang member in his family. He said to me once, "I'm the black sheep in my family." Farm animals, not his strong suit. After meeting my older brother and his wife, he asked plaintively, "What's your brother do for a living?" "Well, he's a principal at an elementary school in San Diego." "And your cuñada?" "She's a nurse at an intensive care unit in a hospital." "Damn, gee," he says, shaking his head with gravity and sadness. "Everyone in your family is somebody." Which I suppose meant that no one in Richard's family was anyone, and neither was he. One day, out of the wild blue yonder, as the homies would say, Richard brings up the flika. "Hey, G, I found this flika," a photograph, "of me yesterday," he said, speaking with more animo, enthusiasm, than I've ever seen. "Yes, a little tiny black and white flika. Maybe I'm 10 years old or something." There seems to be no story to the photograph beyond just finding it. Days later, he returns to the subject, adding little. "Yeah, I'm tripping out on that flika I found. It's a trip to see myself," he says. "Yeah," I say, "you mentioned that the other day." And thinking, "And your point would be..." A week later, Richard appears in my office, smiling and seated in front of my desk. He wordlessly produces the photograph and hands it to me. It is no more than an inch square and reveals an unsmiling Richard at 10. He has a great shock of hair, and since presently Richard's head is shaved, it seems to be a conversation starter. "You got hair, Richard?" I say. He just sits there. So I stare at the kid in the flika and wonder if he is giving it to me. The only way to find out is to offer it back to him. I do, and he doesn't reach for it. "Do you think there's any way to make it big?" "Sure, of course we can," I say. That week, I head to the camera store at the Montebello Town Center. "May I help you, sir?" the guy asks. "Yeah," I say, showing him the flika. "Make it big." The guy was having his doubts about being able to enlarge it much. "Sir," I say, "you have to make this photograph larger than it is." He worked his magic as best he could, and the picture grew to a nearly 4x4-inch photo, gaining a certain grainy, greenish hue in the process. Richard beamed as he held the enlarged, framed, finished product. This is not a story about a photograph. It is a story of the self made to feel too small from being bombarded with messages of shame and disgrace. People call you the black sheep long enough, you tend to believe them. So we reach in, dismantle the message, and rearrange the language so you can imagine yourself as somebody. I grew up in an old, large house. My 5 sisters and 2 brothers and I were told never to go to the attic. This is all we needed to hear. Before long, we were selling tickets to the attic. On one of our forays there, navigating the uncertain planks that kept you from falling through the ceiling below, I guess this explains my mom's prohibition, we found a box of old record albums. One thick red clay recording was labeled "O Holy Night, Kathleen Conway." Conway was my mom's maiden name. We hurried downstairs, placed the record on our toy phonograph, and encircled the speakers, lying on our stomachs, fists propping up our attentive heads. A glorious, though time-worn and scratchy voice came through the speakers. Our mom, it turns out, before she decided to have 8 kids, was an opera singer. We could barely fathom that the voice that hollered at us to come to dinner belonged to this magic emerging from our toy phonograph. We played the grooves off of this record. Consequently, a line from